expect I'll leave it over here by you. And you mentioned Washington. That's one of the things I wanted to ask you about. Your old Tampa battery mate, Walter Johnson, managed the Senators then later
right.
in his career. You were active in the National League at the time Walter was managing in the American League, and he doesn't have a great reputation as a manager, and yet his record wasn't so bad.
No, not too bad.
No.
I was very very lucky. I was a kid here in Tampa. I was born and raised here in Tampa.
Yeah.
And they needed, in those days, the clubs couldn't afford to bring in too many extra men, so they used to only bring three catchers. And being that they had a lot of batting practice and stuff like that, the three catchers, Muddy Rule and Benny Tate and Pinky Hargraves, they call them, were the three catchers of the Washington
right.
club. And so they wanted somebody else to catch bat practice.
Sure.
I was 16 years old at the time. And they were paying me $45 a week.
Well, that was pretty good money.
I would have done it for nothing just to wear the uniform.
Sure.
You know, I was just a stand-lot kid. I had just signed a contract with a local team, the Tampa Smokers. And I caught batting practice for them. And then in 25 in the fall, there was a big boom down here in Florida. And they came through here. And Walter Johnson was a pitcher. He was a star attraction. Bancroft, the shortstop. They had a pretty good ball club. They had two all-star teams. And naturally, they were trying to attract the cigar makers and the people from Ybor City. And they thought they'd ask me to catch. And that's when I caught Walter Johnson in a game. But I had caught him in batting practice, too.
You actually caught him in a game then, too?
In a game, yes.
Good. And then you were off and running shortly after that.
Well, he was easy to catch. You'd be surprised, you know, as fast as he was. But he was right around the home plate, the strike zone all the time.
Yeah.
And he was not hard to catch. The guys that are hard to catch is that can throw like Johnson did and be up and down wild-like.
So.
He was very easy to catch.
You developed some pretty good catchers along the way, too. Jim Hegan was a
great,
excellent catcher, wasn't he?
Excellent catcher. So was Sherm Lawler for Chicago.
That's
I was
right.
very lucky
yeah.
managing, you know, and had good catchers like that.
Right. You also managed fellas who became managers. Dobie, Lemon, Bob Kennedy. I guess you had Kennedy in Cleveland for a
That's
while.
Right.
And
yeah.
perhaps some others.
Yep.
Did you tutor them about managing? Did they ask you for tips about managing? Did they just observe you? How did
well,
that work?
Well, generally you sit there and you talk baseball all the time. More so in the olden days, I imagine they do now, because we used to travel by trains to Hellstead. And it was very nice. So you sit there in your compartment. Your manager's rule had a compartment. You had some questions to ask. They'd come into your compartment and sit there and talk to you about it. I was very fortunate. I had five managers, and they're all in the Hall of Fame. All the managers that I played for were all in the Hall of Fame. I had Wilbur Robinson at Kirkland.
Yeah.
Then I had Max Carey. I don't think he got in as a manager, but he got in as a player.
Yes, he did. That's right.
And then I had Casey Stengel twice.
Right.
At Brooklyn, at Boston.
Boston.
Then I had Frank Frisch. I left Bill McKechnie, who I thought was a great manager, at
yes.
Boston.
Yeah.
I had Frank Frisch at Pittsburgh.
Yeah.
And then I had 1 year when I played a little bit for Cleveland, 1 year for Cleveland, at Lou Boudreau, who's also in the Hall of Fame.
He's all
in the Hall of Fame.
That's right.
I should have learned something from those guys.
Well, evidently you did. Did you talk to them about managing toward the
No, again, here I am, you know, lucky again that every one of those clubs that I joined, they asked me to be the captain of the team. At Brooklyn, Glenn Wright was the captain of the team when I first went up, and after Glenn left there, Casey Stengel made me the captain of the team. I did captain for Max Carey, but I was captain for Casey Stengel. Then I went to Boston, and McKechnie asked me if I would move the infield and outfield. Kind of a captain.
Someone told me, and of course I've been involved with some research too, looking at the record books and whatnot, that those years that McKechnie was in Boston, even though he didn't win the pennant with the Braves, that he did a great managing job.
Sure did. The year the year before I went to that Casey traded me to Brooklyn, traded me to Boston. McKechnie was the worst year he's ever had. That's the year that Babe Ruth ended up, finished that year.
It would have been
1935. And they ended up in last place. And that's when they decided to make some changes. And they made a deal with Brooklyn that got me and myself and Tony Cuccinello. They got, I think, three or four ball players from Brooklyn at that time.
You and Tony go back that far then to Brooklyn days?
Huh? Oh, yeah. Tony started at Cincinnati in 1930, same year I went up.
Yeah.
And in 31, and let me see, 32, I think that they made a deal. It was they got mad at Babe Herman. The deal, from what I understand, this is hearsay, that the Brooklyn Club wanted to sign for $19,000, and Herman wanted $20,000. And he finally came down here to Clearwater. We were staying at the Graymont Sin Hotel in Clearwater. They tried to divide the thing, compromise. And for 19, and Herman wouldn't go for it. They wanted $20,000. So they got mad at him. They traded to Cincinnati the very next day. They traded Herman Lombardi and Wally Gilbert for Tony Cuccinello, Joe Stripp, and Clyde Soufoy. And as you know, Herman was a great attraction. I think it was one of the worst deals I ever saw, because Herman was a great hitter, and I personally think he should be a Hall of Famer.
I think that he still holds the all-time Dodger single season record.
I think so.
392 or something like
that. Oh, he hit 2 years in a row. I think he hit 387 and 392 or something like that.
Must have been a great hitter.
He was a great hitter. Great hitter.
Your friend.
And he turned out to be a pretty good outfielder.
Did he?
At the beginning, you know, he wasn't good. He was a first baseman to make him as an outfielder. I was there when he broke into the outfield.
Your friend Tony passed away recently.
Yes, he did. Yeah, he lived up the street a little ways.
I heard that you fellas remained close friends.
We were very, very close friends.
His wife still living? Is his family?
She's still living. She's up the street here a little ways.
That's nice. I saw you, I chuckled to myself 2 years ago. I happened to be in Cooperstown because I'm from Philadelphia. That was the year that the Carlton was admitted to the Hall of Fame. And you and Rick Farrell were there.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought that you were two of the bounciest guys who came on stage. And you probably were the eldest of everybody.
Yeah, for Rick passed away, too.
Boy, I didn't know that.
Yeah. I'm the oldest Hall of Famer now.
Are you?
He was just, I think, months older than I was. He was a nice man. Rick Farrell was a nice man.
So I heard. Yeah.
Class guy.
Yes. When did you, during your career, think that you feel that you'd like to become a manager?
I, again, being a captain of the team, I managed sometimes when Casey got thrown out a few times.
Yeah, yeah.
And I was left in charge.
Yeah.
And I kind of ran things. But no, I never had any idea. But later on, as years went by, I said I'd like to stay. I wanted to stay in baseball, either a coach or something. And finally, my last year at Cleveland was in 47. That was my last playing day.
Right.
I went to Bill Beck and I told him, I said, Bill, I'd like to get my release. Because I knew I couldn't catch it like I used to catch, and I wasn't satisfied with myself. And maybe I can get a manager's job in the minors or get a coaching job and, stay with some club. I want to stay in baseball.
Sure.
And this my friend Donnie Bush at Indianapolis had been after me. He says, when you quit ball, I want you to manage my team for me.
And you did.
Yeah. And finally that same year, he approached me, and I went to Indianapolis for 3 years.
Yeah.
And that's one thing I think that... it's a great thing for somebody that's a player in the big leagues that's going to manage into the big leagues. I think it would be a great experience for them. They should go down to the minors for a couple of years.
That's interesting because one of the sections in the book, I want to talk to some owners. I've already spoken to two or three of them.
I appreciate that.
About their criteria for hiring and firing managers.
Yeah.
And Bill Giles of the Phillies, for example, said, in his opinion, a manager has to have some minor league experience before he
becomes a big
league. I
agree with him very much. I think he should go down there for a couple of years.
Sure.
It's pretty hard to be a player on the like if I was a player in Cleveland, they want to manage the Cleveland club.
Yeah.
It's pretty hard because you've been chummy.
Right.
Not that you want to be an outcast or
no.
A look from the other players, but you've got to be a little different when you became the manager. You have to have a respect for the players and players to respect you.
Yeah, in fact, Lou Boudreau told me that, and he said that he used almost the same words you just did, and he said that I missed that camaraderie, that fellowship. He said, but I felt that I couldn't be chummy with these three fellas and go to have a drink with
them. That's right. That's exactly right. That's the one thing I missed, being a manager, that I couldn't be among the players, maybe sitting down having a beer with them.
Sure.
It's stuff like that. You couldn't. You had to stay by yourself.
You and Casey over the years were, of course, you're always battling for the planet, but you were good friends, weren't you?
We were real good friends, yeah. Even when he was out of baseball and I was at Pittsburgh, he lived in Glendale, California, and we were training in San Bernardino, and my wife happened to be out there. He invited us to come over, to drive all the way up to Glendale. We did. We drove all the way to Glendale to have dinner with him and his family. I knew Edna very well, too, his wife, very well.
In the Brooklyn days, and then when he was with the Boston Braves, he had that reputation of being a clown, but he was a pretty savvy man.
He was a smart guy. There's no question about it. Yeah, Casey was no dummy.
No,
he was no clown.
No.
I can assure you that.
What would some of your most pleasant memories of managing be? Winning a pennant maybe had something.
I think the main thing, naturally, the main thing is winning. There's no question about it. You got to win. And I think the biggest kick I got is just when I used to get some of the younger players and come in and try to help them along to develop them, and so they can become, you know, real. I got a big kick out of Jim Landis in Chicago, for instance. He was, you know, and he started off real bad, but he was such an asset in the outfield. He was a great center fielder. Turned out to be a real good ball player. And just stayed with him and kind of nursed him along, and he developed into a real good ball player.
Yeah.
Herb Score was another guy. Herb Score was in Indianapolis in '54. And he was voted the outstanding player in the minor leagues at the time. In the middle of the season, he was the outstanding, what you can imagine. He was going to be a great pitcher. And Hank Greenberg, the general manager for the club, came over and asked me, he says, "Al, we got the best ball player in the minor leagues." I said, "That's great. Who is he?" He says, "Herb Scores." "Gee, that's great." I said, "But Hank, we don't need a pitcher. You know, I had the best pitching staff ever."
Absolutely.
"In Cleveland with a bullpen." I said, "Let's don't bring the kid up now, because in the middle of the season, he's going to be under pressure.
Yeah.
Let's let him stay down there and finish the year off." And he said, I told him, "I'll guarantee you next year, the first pitcher in spring training is going to be Herb Score. I'll guarantee you that." And we did. And we kind of nursed him along, and Herb was going to be a great, great pitcher.
What a shame that was.
That sure was.
You weren't in Cleveland when that happened, were you?
No, I wasn't. I was in Chicago then.
Yeah. What were the circumstances of your leaving Cleveland to go to Chicago?
Well, I had been there. We won the pennant, and we had a bad series. And then the following year, we were close to winning again. I think we were two games in front about 2 weeks ago, something like that. And we hit a rut, and the Yankees overtook us.
Yeah.
And after that, I thought, I told Hank, I want to get out. You know, let somebody else have it.
And
we finished, we won one pennant and finished second five times.
And close several times.
Every
too,
time.
Two games out.
I think that during that period, I think we were pretty close to being the second best club in baseball. Because the Yankees were so good.
That's right. That 54 World Series was an aberration, I think.
It was one of those things that happened, you know. It happened to Connie Mack, I think, in 1914, he had a very, very strong team. And the Miracle Braves, who were in last place in the middle of the season, ended up winning the pennant and beating four straight. It was one of those things that happened.
Yeah. It had to be disappointing for you, but as you say, having been connected with baseball all those years, those things do. You know, the Browns used to be you fellas and the Yankees once in a while. Everybody has a hot 2 or 3 days now and then.
When a club is hot, the guys are hot, and they had a good club, there's no question about it. But I think if we'd have started in Cleveland instead of standing in the Polo Grounds, that Vic Wirtz's home run would have been way up in the stands.
That's right.
In center field.
That's right.
And it might have changed the ground around, the game around.
Probably would have.
A series run.
That's right. You were talking earlier about one of the great joys that helping develop young players. You mentioned Jim Landis. You didn't have as many coaches as they have now. Now they got 6 or 7 coaches.
Oh, yeah, no. When I first came to the big leagues, we had 2 coaches, because Wilbur Robinson, our manager, didn't even wear a uniform. He sat on the bench with civilian clothes.
Yeah.
But we had Ivy Olson and we had Otto Miller at first base.
Right.
No bullpen coach. And some of the coaches, some of the clubs only had one coach. McKechnie only had one coach. Hank Gowdy was his coach. And then he had Bob Smith, from Atlanta. He was a pitcher coach on the team, player coach. But he used to coach first base. McKinney used to coach at third base.
Well, now, you know, I guess with so many teams now, they... I should ask you this rather than give you my opinion, but it seems to me that so many of the players who come up aren't nearly as well developed as they were back when there were only 16
teams. Excuse me, no question about it. Well, I'm taking myself for instance. I was 5 years in the minor league before I came up.
Yeah.
And I was just a young kid, but and I reported to the Brooklyn Club in 28 at Clearwater. They had bought me from Jacksonville. I had played 3 years. Well, I played 2 years because my first year I didn't hardly play. I was 16 years old.
Sure.
And I was second string catcher. But after that, I played 2 years. Brooklyn bought me. They sent me to Macon 1 year. And then to Atlanta, and Bobby told me, he says, I want you to catch. I don't want you to sit you on the bench.
Yeah.
I said, I'm going to send you to Atlanta. But he says, I think you're the best catcher on the team right now, but I don't want you sitting on the bench. I think you should be catching. And I told him, I said, if I'm not going to catch, I don't want to go up there and sit down on the bench. I want to play. I want to catch.
That makes sense.
Yeah, I did. They sent me to Atlanta, and I had a pretty good year. Then they brought me up the following year.
Was the teaching pretty good in the minor leagues in those days?
The teaching?
Yeah, the managers and that.
I think the difference is, I don't know, I think too much teaching is not good either. I think that then the player depend on somebody teaching instead of you learning by yourself.
Uh-huh.
The way I learned was watching Buddy Rule and catchers like that. I'm lucky that I was catching in a major league club in the spring training, and I thought I learned a lot from just watching those fellas. I think you can learn more by observing than having to depend on somebody to tell you what to do.
Yeah, if you're really interested in whether it's baseball or how to frame pictures or whatever it is.
I think sometimes too much teaching is not good. I think another thing, if I used to leave whoever was going to talk to her, if I want to say something to one of the players, about something that I thought would improve, I would go to my coaches and I'd let him handle it. And just one man, because if you get two or three guys telling different things, you get the guy confused.
Yeah, absolutely. That happens to me.
You know, they talk about this and that and the other. But that ball is coming at 90 miles an hour and it's sinking and curving and all that kind of thing. And the thing that's natural, you can try to improve is position or standing or something like that, and get a lot of hitting practice. But when you start telling them to try to hit the top of the ball, or do this or do the other, that guy's got to concentrate on that ball coming in.
And that's right, you have a couple of seconds or less.
That's right, to react.
I have been trying to play golf for about 15 years, and I know what you're talking about. Fellas tell me, do this, do that. There's about 47 things you're supposed to know.
I do that right now. I play a lot of golf, and I'm trying to do this.
Yeah.
The first thing you know, I'm concentrating on the swing, then my head flies up, and I dealt the ball and hit it way off the line, something like that.
It looks so easy, doesn't it?
It sure does.
An inanimate ball there, and all we have to do is hit it. I get the thing sideways too often. I want to talk about what, in my opinion, in the book will be maybe some underrated managers, and you don't fall into that category at all. But, again, just based on the records that I've seen, Ty Cobb's teams did a pretty good job in Detroit in the 20s. Now, I know you weren't up quite yet then, but I thought maybe you had talked to some fellas over the years who had played for Cobb.
For Cobb?
Yeah.
Yeah, Donnie Bush, my owner at
that's right, sure.
At Indianapolis was a shortstop on the team. And he said he was a tremendous player. He said nobody had the initiative or the pug or whatever it is, but he was a fiery competitor and he would do anything in the world. And he said that Cobb told him, he said, anytime you're on second base, in those days, Donnie Bush used to steal around 40 or 50 bases a year. And that was a lot of bases. Well, Cobb stole a lot of bases, too. But he says, anytime you're second base, he says, you go to steal third base. He says, if the third baseman goes to cover the bag, I'll bunt the ball. And if a guy stays in there, I'll take it for you to steal third base. Now, I've never heard anybody that quick that could do something like that. But Donnie Bush told me that. He says, he told him, anytime you're second base, he said, once you start, don't stop, regardless if you get a jump or not. And he says, you'll steal third base, because if he goes back, I'll bunt the ball. And if he stays in, you can steal the bag. I've never heard it. But he was a great competitor, no question about that. He wrote me the nicest letter the year that we won the pennant in Chicago.
Ty Cobb?
59.
Yeah.
This might be maybe 6 months or a year before he passed away. The nicest letter, I still have it.
That's nice.
Yeah, real nice. Oh, yeah, real nice. They asked me about this picture. I don't know if you saw the picture or not, about Ty Cobb.
Oh, the movie? No, I did not.
I haven't seen it either. No, I'm dying to see it.
No, I'd like to see it.
And this, everybody that knows me, you know, hey, Al, was he that mean? I says, I guess he was. Yeah. I never played against him. He must have been mean. But I say one thing, he must have had a little good at him because he wrote me the nicest letter I ever received.
That's right. That's right. That was a very nice thing for him to do.
Yeah.
Did Donnie Bush say anything to you about Cobb's temperament?
He was a fiery guy. Nobody on the club liked him.
That's what I was. That's what I suspected.
He said the story. He said himself. Donnie told me the story that he came in one year and he said, "Okay, fellas, I'm going to give you a tip that you can make some money on." He says, "There's a soft drink coming out of Atlanta, and you buy some stock on it, you're going to make some money." It was Coca-Cola, and he bought a lot of shares. I understand he had about $1 billion worth of Coca-Cola stock. Nobody bought a share.
And he recommended it to his team.
teammates. Then I think 2 or 3 years later, Tony said he came back. And he says, okay, you didn't buy Coca-Cola. I'm going to give you another stock. General Motors. This is when General Motors was formed. And they weren't in Publix. Nobody bought a share. I think he ended up with buying about $10 million. He ended up about $10 million worth of General Motors.
He didn't have any pitching on those teams, though. I noticed the Cobb... Cobb's teams hit very well, but of course Harry Heilman was on the team.
Yeah, he had some good hitters, some great hitters.
But I looked to see if maybe the pitchers had better, had good careers before and after Cobb was there, and really none of them did. He just had a lot of fellows that had mediocre careers, whether he was the manager or not.
Yeah, they had some great hitters. Heilman, they had two or three, Wahoo, somebody that they believed this. Joni Bush raved about him as a hitter.
Sam Crawford.
Yeah. Had another guy in left field, too, that was a good hitter. Detroit, for some reason or other, it's true that it's a nice ballpark to hit in, but for some reason or other, they always had some good hitters on that club. K-Line came up.
That's right.
Greenberg, York.
Charlie Gehringer.
Yeah.
Cal had good years in the Detroit.
Yeah, they always had. It's a good ballpark to hit in.
It is.
Same way as Fenway Park, a real good ballpark to hit in.
I was going to ask you who some of your favorite players were, fellas who played for you, but that wouldn't be fair to others if we put that in the form.
You can't say them because they were all favorites. I was lucky enough that I ended up in Cleveland with, you know, a tremendous Bob Feller, Bob Wynn, Bob Lemon, Early Wynn, you know, Mike Garcia, real good, great guys on the club. The pitching staff, because they worked real hard. Art Hooterman, Neuhauser came over there.
Yeah, right on the pitcher.
Alessi and Mossy, those guys.
Yeah.
They were great.
Yeah.
They were all great. Herb Score came along after that. And players like Hagan. How can you hate Hagan? Hagan was a nice guy, you know. How can you keep him? Larry Doby was great on the team. Al Roseman, a personal friend of mine. We still see each other.
He's out of baseball now, isn't he?
He's out, yes.
He was with the Giants.
He's dying to get back in. I saw him in Cleveland doing that period.
Yeah.
He went up there.
Yeah.
He and Lemon and I had a couple of beers together, and we saw him. He says he's dying. He wants to get back in baseball.
Yeah, I'd love to see him get back in.
Yeah.
I thought he did a good job with
he's
the Giants.
He's a good man. He's a smart kid.
That's right.
He's no kid anymore.
Well, I just turned 60 years old. I was saying to somebody recently, that when I first started to follow baseball, all of the players, of course, were older than I was, because I said, it's been years since
I was just at that Williams thing, you know, in the middle of the state.
Yeah.
And I'm looking at all these great players, you know, that were there.
Yeah.
And I said, my God, I've seen all these guys break in as kids.
Sure.
Pee Wee Reese.
Yeah.
The Killebrew.
Yeah.
The whole bunch of them I saw break in as kids.
Yeah.
Now, my God, they're Williams.
Well, you still have the attitude of a kid, though.
Thank you.
Well, you know, you say you play golf, and I can tell you.
Oh, yeah, I try to keep it. If I sit at home waiting, you know, sit around doing nothing, I go crazy.
That's right.
Yeah.
How, in your opinion, I want to ask many fellows this question. In your opinion, how has managing changed over the years? You get into the dugout much, I suppose, anymore. But do you talk to these fellas? What? Tougher now?
I don't know. But, you know, the only thing of, we talked about the American League with the DH and the National League, but nothing. I think, and I don't want to knock it because the American League has been nice to me, and so has the National League. But to me, the DH just takes a lot away from managing.
Certainly it does.
You know, you have to sit there. But right now, with all the coaches they have, and they have a pad there that they keep the lineups and all that. I don't know how we did it, because we never did anything like that. We just go ahead and manage the club.
You got the game played?
That's right. Sure. I never kept any of those stuff. And I didn't have a pitching coach in the dugout like they have, and one in the bullpen. I was fortunate I had one in the bullpen, both at Cleveland. Mel Harder and Ray Berries did a great job for me.
Yeah.
But we didn't have a pitching coach. I had three coaches, four coaches in Chicago. Tony and Dudridge. Tony coached third base, and Dudridge at first base. And John Cooney was with me for a while. Good workers, great workers.
He was from the old Boston Braves club with you too, wasn't
right? Right. Yeah. We were friends. We were good friends. He was a good friend of Casey. Casey liked him. You couldn't help but Johnny. Johnny was a nice guy.
That's what I heard.
Nice man.
Some humorous incidents that you would care to share regarding your days as a manager. Any funny things that jump out in your mind? Things that happen?
Some things that now you look back, you know, and you think, geez, you know, we had an incident with what was the name of the guy that wore glasses, you know, a big right-hander, wild guy. I forgot his name anyway.
Lee Meadows?
No, I'm talking about modern day guy.
Oh.
He pitched for the Yankees. I knew Lee Meadows. Lee Meadows, yeah. I knew him very well.
Oh, Ryan Duren.
Ryan Duren.
Yeah.
He'd come in like a wild man from the bullpen.
But he was drunk all the time. They tell me. I don't know.
No, he turned out to be a real nice guy.
Yeah.
And for some reason or other, every time Landis come up, you know, he would lower the bridge on him, you know. And I finally got to me, and I was, why would he just throw a Jim? And I like Jim. Jim was very quiet. We're playing in St. Pete, and sure enough, he knocked him down again. So I told Joe, I went up and I told Joe, I said, you tell that guy, if ever he throws Atlantis again, I'm going to have somebody from the bull come in, and I don't want to throw his head because he wears glasses. I'm going to drill him in the ribs if I can. I'm going to tell the pitcher to do that. I want you to tell him that. Start the season, we come to Chicago, sure enough, Landis comes up, and he lowered the bull on Landis. I called the bullpen, and we had a Cuban boy, couldn't speak English, by the name of Rodolfo Arias, left-hander. I called the bullpen, I told Ray Berry, I said, Ray, can you get me a sinker ball pitcher? Because a sinker ball hurts more than the other type of ball.
It's like a dead ball.
That's right. It's heavy ball, they call it a heavy ball. And I said, get me a sinker ball pitcher. I don't want him to throw his head. I don't want to hurt him. I just want to let him know that we don't like him throwing at Atlantis. So he said, I can't get a volunteer. In those days, the pitchers had the head.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, sure.
So this Cuban boy volunteered. He said, told Ray Berry, I'll do it. Couldn't speak English. So Ray says, the only guy I can get is the left-hander, Rudolfo Arias. So I said, I want a right-hander. No, there can nobody else. Get sent him in here. I had to speak Spanish to him. I said, I want you to throw him at his head. I want you to hit him right in the back, you know, the rib. He says, okay. So I said, first pitch outside, and the next one hit him, you know. So he threw the first one out there. Ryan wasn't a very good hitter anyway, throwing. So the next one, he threw one outside, and he backed away, and he looked in the dugout and said, yeah, we're going to get you.
Yeah.
And that's when he hit him on the hip bone right here.
Good.
So he says to the pitcher, wait till you come up. And I holler at him, he ain't coming up because I'm taking him out. 25 years later, this happened a couple of years ago in spring training, before last. Went to spring training game in Buena Haven, see the Sox in Cleveland play. I had some friends that invited me to come over there.
Sure.
I went with my son and my two grandsons to see the game.
Yeah.
I'm sitting there, they announced that I'm in the stands. Here comes Ryan Dorn.
No kidding.
as nice as could be. You know? Yeah. Al, so nice to see you. Oh, Ryan, so good to see you. How you been? Fine. Are you living in the... Oh, yeah, I'm living around here. He says, hey, Al, I want to tell you, I wasn't throwing at land. I said, Ryan, I thought you were. That's where he got told a picture of the hips.
And he claimed he wasn't throwing at him.
Maybe not.
But every time he can.
Okay, Jerry.
Excuse me.
That's my sister-in-law.
How do you do? Perhaps I have the driveway blocked.
No. I'll go there. I'll just go around.
Oh, she's going the other way.
I'll go the other way. Thanks, anyhow. I'll see you tomorrow.
Okay, Jerry.
And he claimed that he was never throwing at Jim Landis.
Yeah, he said he was throwing at him.
Didn't that sound? Casey, of course, is reputed to have had said a lot of funny things.
Casey, yeah.
Yeah, I guess he was that way even back when he was younger, when you played for him in Brooklyn and Boston?
The thing of Casey, we fought in the spring training. I was holding, that was the only time I held out in baseball. Yeah, because they had cut me the year before. I think $3,000.
They cut you $3,000?
Yeah, we weren't making that much. That's when the banks got... We'll close the banks, you know. They come up with the idea, well, we don't know what's going to happen. We can't afford it. Anyway, they didn't cut me, but most of it. I got most of it back. Yeah. So that same year, I ended up hitting .301, my second best year in the big leagues. So now I said, I'm going to make them pay for this thing, you know, because I thought there was an injustice. I had caught over 140 games and hit .270. 275 or something like that.
Good year.
Yeah, pretty good. You know, for these days, it's a great year. Anyway, I finally signed. Bob Quinn came over to Kissimmee from Orlando, and I met him over there. We talked, and we got together. The old man, Mr. Quinn and I, turned out to be, he trusted me and I trusted him. He gave me his word, and I said, fine. And I think he liked me for that. Finally signed, I came home, got my stuff, went the next day, so I've been maybe missed it maybe a week, spring training. I go over there, and Casey was the new manager. He was in the clubhouse. I got there about 10:30, 11 o'clock.
This is Boston.
In Orlando. This is Boston.
Yes, right.
Yeah.
The Braves.
Yeah. No, this is Brooklyn.
Oh, is it still Brooklyn?
Yeah, Brooklyn, okay. Yeah. And went over there, and I'm expecting to be working out. Everybody was in the clubhouse. What's happening? Casey was having a meeting. He had a meeting every morning with the players, and he had a fungo in his hand, and he would just talk continuous baseball. He wanted to talk fundamentals, you know. Yeah. Finally, somebody said, Casey, I'm about to get some hitting practice. Well, get some hitting practice. We got very little practice, but he gave you plenty of fundamentals. He did. He was a great teacher. He wanted to teach all the experiences that he had. He called McGraw the old man. John McGraw, he played.
Yeah, was that true? Yeah.
There was a lot of, but there was a thing about managing. There was a lot of those players that came out of there, became managers, and they tried to be like McGraw was. You know, right? And McGraw, I think, was one of the best managers I ever saw.
Apparently, he was terrific with fundamentals.
Yeah.
From whatever.
Very well, he had all the authority, you know.
Whatever
he said went, and he could go to the office and tell him, I want this, and whatever he needed. But not many managers had that same arrangement that they could say, I want this, you know.
Yeah, well, he was vice president or something. He had money in the team, I guess, too.
Yeah. The Giants at that time were even ahead of the Yankees. The Giants was the most powerful machine until the Yankees finally took over. The Yankees used to play in the Polo Grounds.
Sure.
And then they had the John says, we don't want you anymore, so they went across the river and built that stadium over there. And then the Yankees formed a real powerful machine. St. Louis had a great farm system, but nothing like the Yankees.
Oh.
The Yankees had the money and the man. I think Rupert was a great guy, like Yelkie for the team. You know, he didn't care whether he made any money. He had that brewery.
That's right.
And Yelkie was a real nice man. I don't think he made any money or not. He just wanted to have a good one. He had enough money.
He inherited a lot of money, I think.
He did.
Those Yankees with all that money, that had to be frustrating for you because every September they bring
get a hold of Johnny Mize or Johnny Pop or Johnny Schmitz or somebody.
Oh, even before then, you know, when they started building up, they got the general manager from the Boston Club, Barrows.
That's right.
And Barrows finally started bringing players from the Boston Club over there.
Yeah.
Wade Hoyt and Carl Mays and Babe Ruth. And I could name you Everett Scott, the shortstop. They just keep getting. Boston was like a farm club to them
evidently.
In those days.
Like Kansas City became in late
the Yankee farm.
Like a Yankee farm.
Yeah, they
right.
used to get whatever they wanted.
Sure. What would be the toughest part of managing when you were active?
Toughest part of managing, I don't know about today, but when I was managing, and in my case, because I was lucky, was winning, you know. We had real good clubs. Naturally, handling the players is a tough, you know, because every individual is different. For me, it wasn't that tough. I got along real good with them. And again, we were winning.
Yeah.
You know, we had winning clubs.
That makes a difference.
That's a big difference when you win and lose, you know. You finally start getting mad and stuff like that. But I would say tough is the... get along with, if you got a good front office, it's an easy job for you. If you can get along, you know, with a front office, that they can realize that you're doing a good job and that you know baseball.
Yes.
Right now, the front office, in some cases, they think they know more than the manager about the ball players or what they need. And there's nobody that knows more about that ball club than the manager does. I don't care how many reports they got in the office. Of how many scouts. Nobody knows more about those players than the manager.
That's right.
He should know, and I think they should allow him to have the say-so, because it's his job. If he don't win, he's going to be gone. Why should they be telling you to play so-and-so or getting such and such a player for him? When if he don't win, he's going to get fired. Those guys up there are not going to get fired.
No, and some of them really don't have, maybe not many of them, but some of them don't have the baseball backgrounds. They come from Rupert's brewery, maybe he's not an example, but
they go on reports. That, you know, they got scouts.
Sure.
And the scouts are great. Don't say that they know what they're doing, and they bring in any young players. But the guy that knows the players that he's got on his team, who's doing him the best job, who's doing the job for him, is that manager that's with him every day and every night and every minute of the play.
And I guess if you have a good relationship with the general manager, then
right,
he'll listen to you. You might need a utility ball player, second string catcher,
you're
something
right.
You can't go along.
I was in a position. I was lucky that I had good front office guy. I worked real good with Hank Greengard. He respected my opinion, and I respected him. We kind of worked together. And then I went to Chicago, and John Rigney and Chuck Comiskey, very good. Then Bill Beck came along.
And brought Greenberg there.
Yeah, we got along real good. And then after they left, Ed Short, he was the public relations. He and I worked pretty good over there together.
Sure.
Bill Beck, I know for a fact that he would have loved to have me take Satchel Paige. He loved Satchel Paige.
Yeah.
And he used to call Hank. He and Hank were very good friends too. Greenberg. Tell Hank. He was in Miami. He had Satchel Paige in Miami.
Yeah.
Hank, tell Al that Satchel can help him.
Yeah.
I know Satchel can pitch. He could win. He could really pitch. Maybe not often, but you know, and maybe in the boat come in relief for you, because
yeah.
He had a rubber arm.
Yeah.
But his lifestyle, I don't have a thing against Satchel Paige. People think that I didn't like it. I like it. I think he's one of the funniest guys and a great pitcher. But I couldn't let Satchel Paige come in and whenever he felt like it. You know, he might miss two or three days and come in the middle of the ball game. And I couldn't do it, because then the other guys are going to do the same thing if that's what he wanted. It's all right with me, but do it, you know, someplace else. I couldn't stand for that.
No.
So Beck never asked me to take Satchel Paige. And
no,
I appreciate it.
He would have set a bad example for the rest of the guys.
Well, yeah. Sure. Yeah, I would have.
And
we're playing in Hollywood. An all-star team in 47. I was player at Cleveland.
Yes. Yeah.
And they're training in Tucson. And they had a benefit, a heart fund or a March of Dimes. I said, one of those. And they sent me, Hagan was the first string catcher.
Mm-hmm.
So they sent me to Hollywood for this. I think there was the Cubs, the Browns, the Giants, and the Cleveland Club were in the coast at that time. There's only four clubs training there. So they sent me, each club, I think, sent five players, each club. so they could have a game. Sure. They sent me to be the catcher with it. Right. Our manager is Ty Cobb. Yeah. That's who the manager was. So they had block letters. Satchel Paige is going to start in pitching. The place is packed, completely packed.
Sure.
And they sent starlets from the movie studios over to put on a show before the game, you know. And Cobb didn't care about the show or the stuff.
He
wanted to see a ball
game.
So finally he looks up and he says to the coach, I forgot who the coach was, who's our pitcher? And this guy says, that's Satchel Paige. Well, get him up. The game is about to start. Get him over. He's not here. Cobb never heard of that. That fellow not showing up. He's not here. What do you mean? He's not here. Well, get somebody else. So they got somebody else. About the fourth inning, the game was going on, and here walks Satchel Paige from the clubhouse. Walking. Everybody in the stands got up and gave him a standing ovation. They held the game up for about 10 minutes. It looked to me like it was 20 minutes, but they held the game up. Satchel walks over. I'm sitting about a couple of players over, and I'm dying to see this.
Yeah.
And Cobb saw him coming, and he turned his head. So finally, well, Mr. Cobb, yes, sir. My name is Satchel Paige. Oh, is that so? I said, go over there and sit down. He said, maybe I use your name.
It's so good for Cobb.
He wouldn't do it. He wouldn't use it. Oh, the news media gave him hell, and they booed the hell out of him because he wouldn't use it. He wouldn't do it.
Good for Cobb.
Yeah, that's the way. That's Satchel, you know.
Sure.
He didn't care about anything.
No, no. But did you say Bill Beck liked him?
Bill Beck was a, like, I guess he, like a, he was crazy about the guy. Bill liked that kind of thing, you know, showmanship.
Oh, show, that's right.
Showmanship.
But Bill was a pretty good baseball man, though.
Oh, yeah.
He knew his baseball.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
I was always impressed with him as a kid growing up, watching him build the Indians when he first had them in the late 40s. And then he was only there for about 2 or 3 years, I guess. When you became manager of Cleveland, Bill Beck was gone at that point, wasn't he? Already.
Yeah.
Well, I've taken enough of your time. I would love to sit here and talk with you for a long time.